Good afternoon and welcome to today's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, the place where you're in the know. You can find us online at commonwealthclub.org, on Facebook and Twitter, and on our YouTube channel. I'm Corey Shockey of the Hoover Institution, the moderator of this afternoon's conversation. I was the Director for Defense Strategy on the National Security Council in the Bush administration and the Senior Policy Advisor of the 2008 Palin-McCain campaign for president. But I think the reason that the Commonwealth Club asked me to moderate this discussion was that I also held the Distinguished Chair in International Security Studies at West Point, the alma mater of Wes Clark and a place where he taught economics back in his youth. Wes was a soldier in service of our country for 34 years, I think. He graduated as the valedictorian of the class of 1966 at West Point, was awarded a Rhodes Scholarship, studied in Britain, held a number of enormously influential and important military positions, culminating in being the Supreme Allied Commander Europe, the senior NATO military commander, during the Kosovo Air War in the 1990s. And in retirement, he has been an investment banker, a big shot businessman, an author of several good books, one of which he is here today to talk to us about. Won't you join me in welcoming Wes Clark? His terrific book, my copy of which I do not have with me, doggone it, is about, thank you, here we go, Don't Wait for the Next War. It is a cri de coeur about the lack of strategy the United States currently has, our incapacity in understanding and preparing for the set of challenges that our country is facing. And he has very nicely foregone giving the typical 15-minute talk about his book in order to maximize his time for conversation with you all. But I want to toss you a couple of softballs at the start, my friend.
Okay.
The first of which is, tell our audience who have not yet had the chance to read the book the two or three things you most want them to understand from it.
Well, the title of the book, Don't Wait for the Next War, comes because that's what Americans always do. We always wait for war. You know, I think when George W. Bush was running for office in 2000, he was saying he wanted to be like a CEO president. But the last CEO we had on this side of the Atlantic was George III, and we fought the Revolutionary War against him. We don't like strong executive leadership. We have separation of powers. We have checks and balances in the Constitution. And we believe that the politics works best if you get the issues out, resolve them, let interest counteract interest and ambition counteract ambition in formal institutions. We show it all in public. And that's the way the American system works. The result is that we wait to be challenged. We were fortunate because we had a couple of oceans that protected us. But the reason I'm saying don't wait for the next war now is because there are some enormous problems coming our way. And it's not just ISIS. It's not just Putin. It's the fact that the culmination of these issues will threaten our ability to lead the world and manage events the way we've all become accustomed to, really, since the end of the Second World War. We set up the United Nations, the International Monetary Fund, the World Bank, NATO, the treaty with Japan. We fought wars in Korea and Vietnam. We had the Soviet Union. Ike told us, come together. There's so much evil out there that if we're not strong, if we don't submerge the differences between Democrats and Republicans, we can't cope with the challenge posed by the Soviet Union. And it was a winning formula. It mostly worked for 40 years. Now, Democrats and Republicans never got along that well, but, you know, Republicans are always like, let's get some more weapons, let's be tougher, don't trust these people. And Democrats are always like, hey, can't we have a nice agreement? I mean, they look like we could share vodka with them and stuff. And so there was always a disagreement in this, but it worked for the administrations for Ike, for Kennedy, for Nixon, for Carter, for Reagan. And then we lost the Soviet Union, for Ford. We lost the Soviet Union. And when we lost the Soviet Union, we lost our adversary. We also lost our strategy. Now, during the 1990s, when I first met Corey and she was working in the joint staff, and I just came in from commanding the 1st Cavalry Division at Fort Hood, Texas, the first question I was asked is, what's the strategy? So this was like a test question. I went in to see General Shali Kashvili, my boss. He says, Wes, with his Polish accent, Wes, what is our strategy? I said, well, sir, I don't know. He said, go find out. So we ended up writing a strategy. It took us a year or so, and we finally published it. It was called A Strategy of Engagement and Enlargement. And we thought it was a really good product. We identified the nature of the challenges facing us in the post-Cold War environment, and it was erudite. The title sounded like an advertisement for a men's pharmaceutical product, honestly. Engagement and enlargement. But the real problem with it was that Americans weren't engaged in foreign policy. You know, the Cold War was over. There was no challenge out there. So we went our own way. And we had a great decade in the 1990s. We created 22 million jobs. And even the median wage went up across America. Americans never had it so good. I remember when I retired, I stood on that parade field at Fort Myer. It was the summer of 2000. And I just thought, God, what a wonderful thing it is to be an American. I just couldn't wait to get out in the private economy, our investment banking, the dot-com, the technology, all the things I'd been watching and reading about all my life. I was 55 years old. I just wanted, just let me out there, coach. And, you know, we were on top of the world. And the armed forces were in such wonderful shape. I mean, when I was a battalion commander at Fort Carson in 1980, the Europeans told us, you guys, don't come back to Europe. Your troops, they're reckless. They're not disciplined. They're not educated like our troops. Really, it was embarrassing. Boy, nobody said that in 20 years later. There was no question. We were the top of the heap. And then 9/11 happened. And it was war. And we came together just like that. 80% of the American public wanted to strike Saddam Hussein, including the newspaper. Some people said, not so fast, wait. Maybe he doesn't really have these weapons of mass destruction. Didn't do any good. So we rushed through Afghanistan, pulled out the recon, left a few troops there, let Osama bin Laden go to Pakistan, and there we were in Iraq. Now it's 2014. We're back in Iraq. And people are asking, what's the strategy? That's the problem. We have threats from terrorists all over the world, not just the Middle East. We have cyber threats. J.P. Morgan just got hit. Now, we invented the internet. We're threatened by our own invention. We fixed the financial crisis of 2008, sort of, but we really haven't. It's not solidly fixed, and it's still shaky out there, and Europe's about to go back into a recession caused by, I think, austerity, excessive austerity in Europe. And China, it's an ascending power. Never before has there been an ascending power that didn't cause a war to sort of break into the system. Can this be the first time? Can we deal with a country that's four times larger than the United States in population and that has a totally different system of government? And they're not about to come over here and say, gee, we really like democracy. Can we have like your Congress and everything in Beijing to help us? They've got their own system. And finally, climate change. Every day we're pumping out more greenhouse gases into the atmosphere, and every day we're moving toward that mark of 2 degrees centigrade, 450 parts per million of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere that's pegged as the danger zone. So we've got big long-term challenges, and then we've got these sharp crises. So I wrote the book to try to give you a frame for how to think about it and to give myself a frame to how to think about it. So that's what the book's about.
One of the metaphors you use in the book that I very much like comes from golf, which is the question of which is the most important shot in golf. And the answer is the next one. And you use that as a metaphor for anticipating crises. And you suggest that we need, unlike the historical approaches we have had, that we need a qualitatively different approach to managing these problems. Can I ask you to say a little bit more about what you need, what you mean in that regard, or pick one of the five shaping problems that you identify in the book, and give our audience a concrete sense of what we qualitatively differently need to do?
So let's take the case of China. So we know China's growing. For 30 years, they grew at double-digit rates per year. China has a long-term strategy. They send their young people here to get education. They take our technology back. They ask for Western investments. They look at the technology. They use cheap labor to capture foreign exchange. They're using the foreign exchange to buy up natural resources around the world. They're building their own educational system, learning from us on how to do it. And they're building up their military. So their goal is to become the China dream. That's Xi Jinping's phrase, but what does it mean? Nobody quite understands. But in the summer of 2013, they published document number 9, which says the greatest enemy of China is Western democracy and the idea that you could have freedom of speech and freedom of opinion and human rights. This would destroy China. And so it has to be squashed at every opportunity. And so the China dream isn't about democracy. It's about something like restoring China's historical role in the world. China wants to be the center of world civilization. So what we're doing now is we're reacting to every little thing that comes along. So China declares a new, what they call, an air defense identification zone in the Pacific. Says if you fly through this airspace, you got to report to me. I'm China. We said, no, we don't like it. We flew a couple of bombers through it, but it's still there. And China says, those islands over there, those are our islands. And by the way, Okinawa, where you got those marine stations, that's Chinese territory. Now, we see this happening, and we talk about it, but what's our long-term strategy to work it? One of my friends, Clyde Prestowitz, jokes, he says, there's never been an American president who wouldn't give away a strategic industry to win a smile on the face of a foreign leader. We've had president after president go to China and to get better relations say, we're going to help you with your high-tech industry. We're going to help you with your aviation industry. In 2011, GE said, there was a GE spokesman who said, the future of civil aviation is in China, and GE will be there, which is great for GE. But where's the avionics? Where did they develop? Did GE put its own money into developing those avionics? No, GE put a lot of its money into buying back stock. But it took taxpayer money dedicated to the U.S. military to develop those avionics that are being shared with China in their joint venture to develop Chinese civil aviation. That's in the best interests. It's like when I went to Cornell in 2005. I asked the president of Cornell, I was giving the commencement address, I said, so how's it going with your relations? Do you have any relations with China? He says, excellent relations. He said, we have relations with 5 universities. They send their graduate students here. They do research with us. They learn from us. And they take those lessons back to China. I said, that's great. I said, now what does Cornell get out of this? He said, well, good relations. And so when you look at this, you say, okay, well, you can see China's trajectory. You sort of know where they're headed. You see what we're doing here. So what happens? We're going to come to a collision on this. What's our strategy not to collide? I was in China last year, and the Chinese, one of my friends there in China, is apparently well-connected. He put it this way. He said, we know everything in your companies because 60% of your Fortune 500 companies have research and development centers in China, and we know everything in them. We know all about NASA because we have Chinese scientists who work there. You think you're going to put your bases in the Philippines, but we give the Philippines $3.5 billion a month in remittances through Hong Kong. If we don't give them those remittances, there'll be no bases there if we tell them we don't want those bases. By 2019, we will have 4 aircraft carriers in the northern Pacific.
So
when you look at this, you say, this doesn't sound friendly. This doesn't sound friendly. What's the strategy? So that's the problem I'm addressing.
I want to press you on this a little bit more because I agree that the American government very often doesn't have a strategic perspective. But it does seem to me that the one country on which at least the last 5 American presidents have had a consistent grand strategy is actually China. And that strategy has been identifying what Bob Zoellick, when he was the head of the World Bank, described as a responsible stakeholder. That is, we are in favor of a prosperous China. We are in favor of a strong China, provided that that China plays by the rules the United States established. And we had that policy, have had that policy, in the expectation that authoritarian capitalism is impossible to sustain. That as people begin to have their needs met, they grow more demanding of their government. That freedom is, as the founding fathers say, inherent in human life, and that everybody yearns for it, not newly. If I understand what you're saying just here and in the book, you think that's a mistake. And so I want to know the China policy you would advocate. Are you saying that we shouldn't be doing business in China? Are you saying that we shouldn't be educating Chinese students? Are you saying that we should be more confrontational with the Chinese, even if our allies in Asia are unwilling to? Help me see the policy agenda that goes with the strategy you're outlining.
Well, saying that we want China to be a stakeholder, that's a responsible stakeholder. That's not a strategy. That's an aim. That's a goal. So when we started this strategy, we always hoped that China would evolve democratically. As Corey said, we never could imagine you could have an effective modern economy without freedom of information and allowing the sort of trappings of the beginnings of democracy. So we saw an evolution toward a more open China. That's what we sought. But as we've watched this emerge, it's not becoming more open, it's becoming more closed. Now, we've been a little ambivalent in our own policies because on the one hand, we've said we believe in constructive engagement, but we've also maintained our defense treaties. Now, China's neighbors, China is not always a nice neighbor. When I talk to these countries, they tell me about the Chinese ambassadors who come in, and actually they're pretty pushy, and they're pretty tough on these local countries. So they come to the United States and look for help. And as Corey implied, they don't want a confrontation with China, but they want another shoulder. They want us out there. We have to find a more strategic course with China, one that doesn't assume that they will automatically mirror us and become democratic. They're going to have their own system of government. And to deal with China, we have to deal from a position of strength because they don't look at personalities. They're not charmed by the best-looking presidents or the most articulate speeches. They're looking at China's long-term interests and how they advance them. So we've operated for 40 years on a basis of hope. It's time to look beyond that and say, okay, we're going to have a country that may have a GDP larger than our own. It's not going to be a democracy. It's going to be after what it wants. How do we deal with that country? Number one, we put our own economy in order. Number two, we make sure we talk to the Chinese privately in advance. They're very open about what their intentions are. We knew they were going to claim those islands. Talk to them in advance. Don't let them get out front. Number three, we maintain the effort on multilateral forum and international law. So when they say we want those islands, they take it to The Hague. Let's look at the maps. Let's go back to international law. And we invest in our military and keep our military strong enough that we can go toe-to-toe with China in a crisis. They have to understand, if they're rattling intercontinental ballistic missiles in our direction, which they've been doing recently, then we're likely to come back by saying, you know, that air defense system or anti-ballistic missile system we put in place in Alaska that was supposed to protect against North Korea, maybe it should be strengthened. Maybe there's another power it should be protecting against. The Chinese have to understand that their actions have consequences and that we have the courage and the means to take those actions that are necessary in response. That's what I mean by having a long-term strategy. That can't be done by a quick visit to China with some favorable headlines. But at the same time, we can't expect that we can overturn the Chinese government. We don't want to do that. So I know there's a lot of sympathy for the Hong Kong demonstrators and pushing for democracy, but really the system in China on the mainland, that's their choice. That's not our choice. We don't have the Communist Party in the United States. But when we push for democracy, we get the mirror image response from China that we're trying to overturn their system of government. So we're going to have to be respectful of their right to choose as a nation. They're going to have to be respectful of the world that we established at the end of World War II. And if we want to retain that world, we're going to have to make sure we're strong enough, first economically and then militarily, to defend it.
So let us move on to the economics, because one of the really interesting sections of your book is about economic power as hard power. And you have several specific suggestions for improvements to the American economy. And I think this California audience would be especially interested in the energy piece of it, and in particular how you balance your strong support for energy exploration, energy production in this country with conservation and preservation values.
Are you with me that the American economy is not creating jobs and growing the way it should be? I mean, that's pretty clear after the financial crisis, right? So how can you do it? So I'm in the investment banking world. In fact, one of my banking partners, Joe Endoso, is here with me now. We're in a company called UGR, and we look across the industry and we raise money for companies. If you want to raise money for companies that are doing apps for iPhones, it's pretty easy. A couple of young guys in their mid-20s, Stanford graduates, come in and say, "We got this great idea to do." And how much do you need? $250,000? Done. You come in with real projects that employ lots of people, that turn the earth, that require development and building things. And you think about where this country is right now. You realize we're not doing that in infrastructure or in industry nearly as much as we did 50 years ago. So how do we get this started again? Well, Warren Buffett, a guy who's everybody, you know, says he must know something about investment. He's made plenty of money. One of his favorite sayings is invest in a company with wind in its sails. In other words, look at the sectors of the economy that are growing and push on an open door. What's growing is the energy sector, the hydrocarbon sector, and the biofuel sector in this country. For over 40 years, America's been an oil importing country. We now have the technology, we know we have the financial resources, and we have the mineral resources and bio resources not to import oil anymore. We're importing between $200 and $300 billion a year worth of oil. It's like a tax. It's like if somebody came to this country and said, "I want $1,000 from every American, man, woman, and child, or you will be invaded," we'd fight. That's like the Barbary pirates. You know, you can't do that to us. But that's, in fact, what we've done to ourselves. Because every time Americans go to the filling station and we fill up the car, some of that is imported. And that import is a tax on the American economy. If you want to grow this economy, the fastest way to grow it in real terms is to aim for full energy independence and go beyond it so that we become the Saudi Arabia of energy. We could do it. We could do it with, yes, you're going to frack, and you got to do it in a safe way, and we know how to make it safer. But you can use coal and turn it into diesel fuel and gasoline. You can use natural gas for propulsion. You can do a better job on electric power. But in the near term, we need liquid fuel because you've got 250 million cars on the road. So if we focus on that, we can really move this economy forward. Now, we need to couple it with stronger environmental controls over the oil industry. So I like the way we do it in the security business. You know, after the Depression, we did the Securities and Exchange Commission, and we set up something called the National Association of Security Dealers, which was an industry self-regulatory organization. You could do the same thing for the oil and gas industry. They have all the technology better than the states do. They can inspect their own wells and certify them and be responsible for them. And if you did that, there's no one in the world that can do a better job of extracting hydrocarbons than Americans. We need to follow through on the renewable fuel standard. We can substitute 3 million barrels a day of imported oil. We can use biofuels for this. So there's a lot we can do, and that's the fastest way to get this economy growing and to give us a leadership position. Now, I advocate, in addition, we need to put a tax on carbon in liquid fuels. And I would peg that tax at just nominally $25 a ton. That's about 20 cents a gallon for gasoline. Price of gasoline's gone down more than 20 cents in the last 3 months. So Americans would hardly see it. But what it would do is it would establish America as a global leader in being able to deal with climate change and project our policies forward to deal with in the future. It's a long-term strategy. We know that 30 years from now, we don't want to be using all this hydrocarbon, but it's here now in our soil. Why don't we use it? Strengthen America, put in the right environmental controls, and then take the lead in the technologies to get us away from hydrocarbons in the 15, 20, and 30-year time frame going out. So I've mapped this out in the book. I can show you how to do it, and I've worked in a lot of these industries, so I know it's real. We just have to come together on this vision. Now, I would tell you we're going the opposite way. Right now, the oil industry is in trouble in America. It's kind of sad.
I'm sorry to break in on you, but I want to remind our radio audience that this is the Commonwealth Club of California, and we are talking to Wesley Clark about the news of the day and his new book, Don't Wait for the Next War, A Strategy for American Growth and Global Leadership. I'm Corey Shockey, your moderator. You can hear the Commonwealth Club programs on the radio, catch up with us on Facebook and Twitter, and see program videos on your YouTube channel. Wes, before we move on to the great questions that have come in abundance from this great audience, I want to give you the chance to speak about the Walter Russell Mead's critical review of your book in the Wall Street Journal yesterday, because I suspect you will want the opportunity to rebut it. He says, I'm reading from his review, he, Wes Clark, believes that a strong federal government closely linked to powerful firms in the private sector will promote economic development at home and ensure national security abroad. The nation, he argues, should maintain strong and capable forces for global power projection, but should avoid combat where possible. Mr. Clark's propensity to propose federal spending that would benefit industries and interests with which he himself has been closely connected will raise the hackles of many small government advocates.
Well, actually, I'm glad you gave me that opportunity. I don't think that I'm actually proposing federal spending. What I'm actually doing is proposing increased growth in the economy, which will result in a reduction of the deficit. And it will result in enough money that you can do whatever else you need to do, and you'll have less impact on the economy. One of the reasons we're in the fight we're in is because the economy is not growing. If the economy were growing 4%, 5%, 5.5%, 6% a year, you wouldn't have these issues. Now, could this economy grow that fast? Yes, it can. In 1940, on the eve of World War II, this economy grew 17% in real terms. In 1941, 16%. In 1942, another 11%. That's 44% in real terms. But that took a war. It doesn't take a war now. But if we just go after these energy resources, and these, by the way, these aren't big companies. Most of this energy work is done by small companies. These are entrepreneurial folks that are out there. They're not just in oil and gas. They're all across the economy. We just need to turn them loose and let them go. And if we do that and this economy takes off, we'll end up with a greater rate of growth, millions of jobs created, a much lower deficit. We'll be reducing the national debt instead of adding to it. And we won't be talking about cutting Social Security and Medicare. We'll be talking about building our infrastructure and rebuilding America. That's where we want to be.
Thank you. I am going to go now to questions. And one of the first that comes across is actually about Vladimir Putin's Russia and Ukraine. One of the you had some particular experience with the Russians during the Kosovo air war that looks to me actually pretty similar to the behavior of the Russians and Ukraine. Does it to you? How should we be handling Vladimir Putin's Russia?
So when I was helping Richard Holbrooke negotiate the Bosnian settlement at Dayton in 1995, I went in with Deputy Secretary of State Strobe Talbot to Moscow. It was October 1995. One of the Russian generals met me and said, "We know what you Americans are up to in Eastern Europe. This is our part of Europe, and you're coming into it. And you say you'll be gone in a year, but you won't be." I said, no. The President Clinton's already said we're going to come out of Bosnia. Troops will be there for a year, and then we're leaving. He said, "Please, we are Russians. We understand you. But don't worry. We would do the same thing in your position." So the Russians see the world as a chessboard. And when we didn't come out of Bosnia right away, they didn't like it. When we took action in NATO in Kosovo, they didn't like it. So we were running the air campaign there. We did 78 days of bombing to halt Serb ethnic cleansing in Kosovo. And on the 10th of June, we got an agreement in the United Nations to stop the bombing and that we were going to get NATO forces in there, be the peacekeepers, the Albanian refugees could return. And I could finally relax. I shot my best score in golf that night. And the next morning I went in the office after a good night's sleep, and at 8 o'clock in the morning I had a call from a guy on the ground in Bosnia. He said, "Sir, the Russian troops that were in Bosnia, they're pulling out. They're crossing the Drina. They're on the highway. They're going into Serbia." And so we spent the Friday, the 11th of June, with CNN watching this Russian battalion driving down the Autobahn toward Pristina Airport. NATO couldn't figure out what to do. There was lots of confusion inside. And the next morning at 1 a.m., the Russians arrived at the airfield that was NATO's objective in Kosovo. So we followed that with a long series of back and forth. And after 4 years, the Russians gave up on Kosovo and left. We won, but behind the scenes, I think it was Vladimir Putin, who was the intelligence chief, who was helping to run this operation at the time, along with the colonel general who was head of the Russian military intelligence, Colonel General Ivanov, who received a big award for running this operation. That was the start of it. A few months later, I read that some apartment buildings had been blown up in Moscow. They were blaming the Chechens on this. But when in the third apartment building people found explosives there, it turned out they were all Russian official explosives. And people remembered seeing that a Russian government agency had come and planted those explosives. So they called and the agency said, "Congratulations! This was a test and you have succeeded in passing the test. You found the explosives we planted." Many people believe that it might have been actually Vladimir Putin looking for an excuse to restart the war in Chechnya. He did restart the war in Chechnya, and he then became prime minister and president. So we've seen this play out before. We saw it in 2008 in Georgia. We saw it in Ukraine. The United States doesn't need Ukraine to be a member of NATO, but we did enlarge NATO because we wanted to help assure stability in Europe. We said it was not just in our interest, it was in Russia's interest to stop the instability in Europe. But the Russians never quite believed it. And Putin, for a long time, has harbored the dream of reintegrating the Soviet space. He wanted Ukraine. And so when Ukrainians decisively decided no, then he took action, seized the Crimea. Today, Eastern European leaders they're a little uncertain. We've said the right things, but they're not sure. We haven't given the military assistance to Ukraine that the Ukrainians have asked for. And they fought a really tough fight to try to regain control of their own territory, ending when there was a massive Russian intervention into Ukraine, an invasion. 10 combat task forces, lots of heavy artillery, big firefight, several hundred soldiers killed, and then a ceasefire. None of us know what Putin's going to do next, but we're all watching. So, yes, Ukraine is a problem. Putin is a problem, and we don't know whether he'll be satisfied with this. But the last time we saw someone who was in charge of a European country after they had lost territory and felt that they were improperly treated by the world community was in the 1930s. And that leader began very cautiously. He rearmed carefully, looking around to make sure no one really took umbrage when he violated the Versailles Treaty. He then reoccupied the Rhineland. Nobody raised any objections. He then took Austria. Nobody raised any objections. Now we're watching Putin's move. He's talking about nukes. He's talking about Novorossiya. We don't know where he's headed. But we do know that we've seen this play before. We don't want it to go any further. So that's our concern.
Thank you. There have been several questions to transition, and I want to pick one to help us transition from Ukraine to the Middle East. And the question is that you ran the most successful air war since World War II. And the question is, will air only be effective against ISIS?
No, it's not going to be effective. Look, the Kosovo campaign was an effort to... I'd spent 100 hours with Slobodan Milosevic, the dictator there. I mean, I knew how he thought. I knew he was afraid of NATO. I knew he was a lawyer. And honestly, he had sort of big, puffy, soft, white hands. And I said, Mr. President, what sport did you do as a young person? He said, General Clark, he said, I did no sports. My mother wanted me to study. I'm sorry. I mean, I went to West Point, okay? I mean, we knew we could break his will. But when it comes to ISIS, it's not the will of someone in ISIS. You've got to actually deal with their capabilities. So everybody says, well, will it take boots on the ground? The answer is certainly. But boots on the ground and air power, that's necessary but not sufficient. What you have to be able to do to win is to restore governance over that space. Governance. And who is going to govern it? We've already proved we can't. Syria is not going to be the 51st state. So we can't do it. They have to do it. That's why the idea of going with a regional coalition, and especially bringing in the moderate Syrian opposition, is so vital. Because there has to be governance on that space after you put the boots on the ground.
Another question from the audience, is Turkey's refusal to militarily engage ISIL on its own border irresponsible in a NATO member?
It's a complicated situation, and I think that if ISIL takes Kobani, there'll be a tremendous shock, and it will be viewed as a strategic and moral victory for ISIS. But put yourself in Turkey's position. So they know that if they go in, they're invading Syria. They don't want an unsupported war with Bashar Assad. They also know that Syria is linked with Iran. And Iran can give aid to the Kurds and restart the rebellion inside Turkey. So they're asking for American support. They're asking, what will we do to help them? And before we say, well, we're not going to do anything, it's your problem. Remember, Turkey's a member of NATO. So if they were to engage by themselves with NATO's standing back, and the Kurds then, aided by Iran, come in, and Turkey comes to NATO and says, under Article 5, I've been attacked by Iran and by Syria. NATO, I demand assistance. Then we're in it. So there's a lot of tough issues here beyond simply those tanks on the hill overlooking Kobani. Now, what I would like to see us do is I'd like to see us tell the Syrian opposition, you're going to become the governors in this space. It's your country. So the Turks are going to support you temporarily. We'll put air cover over you for that limited space. We're going to end the problem of Kobani, and then we're going to, you know, talk about where we're going from there and get the Syrian opposition on the ground inside Syria in a way that they can begin to control the armed groups. I think there's, if you look at the map of Syria and you say which groups in which area, it's like a kaleidoscope. It's the craziest thing you've ever seen. And somebody has to put all that together. It's not us. But what we have to do is we have to make sure where our interests are impacted by what happens in Syria, we have to protect those interests. And we do not want ISIS to metastasize into a full-blown state that's directed at attacking us with terrorism. So we know we don't want that. So we got to work with the people in the region. We got to do what we can. But this is primarily their problem. Religious zealotry is involved. And you cannot put a Judeo-Christian army in as an occupying power in this region and be successful. We proved that. So let's don't repeat that mistake.
So there are a number of questions about the American military in particular, and about military-related issues, and I'd like to move to those now. The first is whether we should reinstitute the draft and whether the public would have a different attitude about our involvement in wars if we have the draft.
Well, I think the answer to both those questions is yes. It would be a wonderful thing if Americans came together and said, we believe we should serve. But the truth is, in this country, the draft's never been very popular. And it wasn't popular when it was on. Now, a lot of people who served say, oh, I learned the best lessons of my life peeling potatoes out there with the 1st Infantry Division and so forth. I'm sure they did. But when you ask young people to give up 2 years of their life and they don't want to be there, you also degrade the quality of the armed forces they're coming into. This is an issue that does need to be discussed. I can tell you that the leadership of the Army does not want the draft. It's one of those things that would be great for the country if everybody served and bonded together in this. But people don't want to do this. It would be a tough political issue. And we really closed the door. When we moved the voting age from 21 to 18, and now you want 18-year-olds to vote on whether they should be drafted or not. Now, I'm hoping we'll see a candidate in the next election who wants to run on this platform. Congressman Charlie Rangel told me when I was running in 2003 that I should run on reinstituting the draft. I didn't think it was the right thing for the military, so I couldn't do it. But I think it's also a really tough sell for America. It's unfortunate because we've asked the armed forces to bear a really unfair burden in this. We did it deliberately. And I was there as a captain when President Nixon said we're going to go to a volunteer force. We felt funny about it at the time. It didn't seem right because even though the draft was inequitable, at least, you know, everybody was theoretically on the hook. And President Nixon looked at it and he knew that in the future we'd have challenges. We couldn't afford to have another Kent State every time we got in a war where there were hundreds of thousands of people demonstrating and killing and people dying and so forth. So he thought he could avoid it with a volunteer force. And I think he was right. And somehow we have to come to terms with that in this democracy. My heart aches when I see these men and women in uniform in our airports, some of them with multiple tours. They go over there, they suffer danger and stress, they come home, and it's as though the people back here they don't feel connected anymore to this society. I don't know what we can do, so I hope we'll be able to navigate our way through this without American boots on the ground. And that's why I'm urging we use a moderate Syrian opposition to do it. Our military is great, never had a better armed force. They're very, very capable, but let's don't put them in the game right now. Let's give them a break.
Another person in the audience asks, a recent Pew Research poll revealed that when Americans were asked what traits they were most likely to support in a presidential candidate, 43% responded military experience. Any reflections on why that might be?
Well, you know, the military is viewed widely as one of the most successful and admired institutions in America. It normally accomplishes the mission, it has high integrity, it has high standards, and if you look at the other institutions in America, they typically don't. What's the approval rating of Congress? Okay? And I'm not going to ask you to name Barack Obama's approval rating in the White House. But, you know, the military is apart from politics. People respect the men and women because of they're laying their lives on the line, and they've been successful. And so that's why they say that. Now, when you actually get into the race, then I want to tell you it's a different matter. My wife told me, she said, you think it's going to be like you're a general in that race. She said, but once you become a member of a political party and announce, then 30% of the American people don't like you. And I have had a lot of questions about why I'm a Democrat as a former military guy. There's a lot of people who don't understand it.
So
but I became a Democrat because I was against the war in Iraq. That's the simple answer. I knew it was a mistake. I knew we shouldn't go there. I knew it wasn't justified. But I also found in the military that if you want a winning unit, it's about the troops. It's not about the colonel giving the briefing. It's about the quality of the people at the bottom of the organization, their morale, their skill, their determination. I think America's like that. I think if you want a great country, you have to look across America. There's always going to be a Bill Gates. There's always going to be a great hedge fund manager. There's always going to be geniuses that come up. They're going to take care of themselves. But what about the ordinary people who work every day? They pay their taxes, they raise their kids, they want a good life. We had a bargain in this country that when America did better, everybody did better. And for at least 60 years, it worked. It's clear it's not working that way right now. So I think we got to get this country moving again by investing in energy, but I think we got to make sure that the gains go throughout the economy, just not to the top 1% and 0.1%. I'm in favor of the troops, and that's why I'm a Democrat.
So the next question comes from a member of our audience who is here to honor their mother, who died a year ago at 99, and says that you are the mother's favorite politician. The question is, why are liberal voices so rare in the military? How did you find yours? I would add the question, are liberal voices that rare in the American military? Do you believe that the military is more conservative politically than the rest of society?
I don't think that, you know, mostly the military, at least when I was in it, it wasn't anything. We weren't political. I mean, I was in the Ford administration as a White House fellow. I went back and forth. I remember going in there a year after Nixon had left, I showed up and the guy called me in. I said, but why are we doing this? He said, Clark, he said, if you ask questions like that, you can't work here. I said, Jiminy Christmas. I mean, okay. But I worked for a guy named Jack Marsh. I worked around Don Rumsfeld and Dick Cheney occasionally in the White House in that period. So I saw that side of it. And I was a strong believer in national security. I voted twice for Ronald Reagan. I believe you can't have a strong country if you don't have a strong national security program. But having said that, I also learned the greatest lesson of my life when I was a captain. And I was, you know, I was in a calculus class in high school. I turned down, I had a National Merit Scholarship and an Honor Society Scholarship and all that stuff. And here I was, a company commander in Vietnam, had 116 guys, and about, I'd say, two-thirds of them weren't even high school graduates. I mean, they were from all over the country. They had FTA on the helmets. And I mean, it wasn't my calculus class, okay? And so we're out patrolling, and I accomplished the mission. I found the enemy. I was the first guy shot. And I'm laying on the ground bleeding, and the bullets are coming in, and it sounds like the shootout at the OK Corral. And I said, I'm hollering back at the troops, get the machine gun up! Get the machine gun up! And there's about 15 guys in the jungle with me. And they were teenage gang members. They were dope smokers. They were draftees. I mean, maybe one of them had a year of college. And when I called, they came. And they laid down a base of fire with that machine gun. And after about 3 minutes, I realized there was no more incoming rounds. And I said, stand up and assault. On the right, on the left, shift fire. These guys on the right stood up. They put their M16s on their hip, and they marched into the jungle firing. I mean, that's America. And I loved them. So I don't know if they were liberals or conservatives, and I didn't care. But what I did learn is that if you care about the people in your organization, they will come through for you. And in America, we have to care about every single American. I don't care if they don't have jobs. I don't care if they're sitting in a house and it's in bankruptcy. I don't care if their kids are in trouble. They're our people, and we need to be doing the best we can for them. So I think if you really went to the heart of the military and you asked the people at the top, they'd all say that. They just don't connect it to politics. They all believe in the troops. The 8th Infantry Division has a great motto. In 1945, when the 8th Infantry Division was moving through Germany, the commander called on the Germans in this fortress to surrender. And the German general said, I will not surrender until I see your credentials. So the American general commanding the 8th Infantry Division wrote back and said, my soldiers are my credentials. There's no stronger statement of what the Army stands for, and I believe that's what America stands for. And I think that if you really went to the military leadership and asked it in that way, they'd all say the same thing. It's just, let's don't get it into partisan politics. The military doesn't have any business in partisan politics. When you get out, fine, you can do whatever you want. But when you're in there, just vote, and vote your heart, but don't get involved in the partisan politics.
Which takes us to partisan politics, and several of the questions, have to do with the practicality of how to get those partisan politicians to support the program that you advocate in the book. Give us your 2-minute elevator pitch to Senator Barbara Boxer about why she should do the things on energy and other elements in your book.
Well, I'm going to get an appointment with Barbara here shortly and actually do it, so this may be a good warm-up. Barbara, are you listening? So, Barbara, we need to get the American economy growing again. We've got the resources we need. We've got the finance. We've got the technology to be energy independent, and I believe we can do it in a way that's environmentally sensitive and puts us on the road to dealing effectively with global climate change. What we need is to bring America together. The question is, Senator, are you willing to participate in that effort? Will you come together with Senator Imhoff from Oklahoma? Will you sit down with him and say, we can work together as Americans to make this country great and strong? Or is each of us so caught up in our particular interests that we can't come together as a nation? And then I'd say, Barbara, don't wait for the next war, because that's what this is about.
So to go further down the Democratic Party politics rabbit hole, there are two questions about specific individuals in your party leadership. The first is, First question that an audience member asks is, has Hillary Clinton read your book, and how would she review it? And the second question is about Leon Panetta and any comments on his decision to release his memoir so fast while the president is still sitting?
Well, I don't know if Hillary's read the book or not, and I welcome her comments on it. But as far as Leon's book is concerned, you know, when you get out of office, you have a right to say whatever you want. I probably wouldn't have said it quite that way. I haven't read the book, but I did see that in the excerpts, he said a lot of very nice things about Obama. It's unfortunate that in Washington, we like to play the finger-pointing game. This is an inside-the-beltway discussion. The outside-the-beltway discussion should be, where is America headed? You know, in poll after poll, the American people always say, we're going in the wrong direction. It's like 65%, 70%. Is America headed in the right direction, yes or no? And they always say no, but they never say what direction they're supposed to go in. That's the leadership's responsibility. So I wrote this book to stay out of partisan politics, because what I hope is that people will look at it on both sides of the aisle and say, you know, there's a chance to work together on this and make the country better. Let's set aside the partisan politics. I think the American people are so tired of partisan politics and this name-calling and the ads that are on television night after night after night. I mean, they just want us to go in the right direction, do the right things for the country, and to work together in a collegial fashion. And I hope we can do that. I hope this book will provide enough discussion to help spark a little of that.
In our last several minutes, I'm going to try and fire off a couple of specific questions that came in to get answers to. The first is about modern conflicts, in particular, cyber conflicts. And it's a subject you address at great length in the book. The question is, of the modern conflicts we hear about on the news, there seems to be a growing amount of hacking attacks, which the news media often directly identify as Chinese or Russian. However, I rarely hear about any substantive U.S. response other than a complaint to the foreign entity's State Department. In my perception, the U.S. response seems to be casual at best, especially given the level of damage.
Well, number one, we are the most vulnerable country to cyber attacks. So that's the first thing. Number two, we don't have comprehensive legislation in place to defend against it because the Congress, the Senate, has blocked this legislation. It'll be introduced again this year. To make it work, we have to charge businesses a tax so that the cyber command has the resources to protect them. And if you were in business, you probably wouldn't want to pay that tax either. But so we can do more. But having said that, we also use the cyber, the net, to do reconnaissance, to prepare. I mean, you've heard of Stuxnet, and I'm sorry to say that we somehow admitted that we did Stuxnet to the Iranian nuclear program, and we did it. So we actually went in there and using the internet, sabotaged a bunch of machines that they had that were reprocessing upgrading their uranium. So we started it. And if you went inside the Council of Government and you went to the president and said, Mr. President, we have to have an absolute ironclad treaty to prevent all this, full investigations, treat it as an act of war when they come after us, what might happen is some people in government might say to the president, Mr. President, if we do that, you're going to block us from doing the things we need to do to protect America, to acquire sensitive information, and to be ready to respond if we're called on to do so. So it's right now, it's inchoate. This policy, it's there. Last summer, the Iranians messed up some banks. They shut down their online banking. They didn't actually cause any material damage to the accounts, and I heard three sources of explanation from the government. Explanation one was, well, they didn't do any damage, so we didn't do anything. Explanation two was, well, it was private property, so we didn't do anything. Explanation three was that if we'd done something, we didn't know what they'd come back to us with, and they might have come back and done real damage, so we thought we'd let it lie. I don't know what the correct explanation is. I'm not inside the government anymore, but I do know this, that we don't want to be in a position where we cannot defend ourselves in a cyber environment. And that means we do need legislation, and we need to take this threat very, very seriously.
That your response affirms the questioner's concern that the government's pretty casual about this, sure. Even with the nature of the threat. One of the most interesting parts of your book for me was your discussion of the technology industrial complex, or the security industrial complex. You very clearly are anxious about the extent to which we are, for example, that you use in the book is that 60,000 Americans die by violence every year, none die by terrorist violence, and yet we are disproportionately skewing our concern towards the terrorist threat. Can you, as a final closing statement, can you expound a little bit on how to hit that balance right?
I don't know how to get the balance right, but I do know that when you talk to civil libertarians, and I was at UCLA Law School last year to do this, and they said, we have to get this right. I mean, we can't have the NSA in there intruding on everybody and everything. I said, fine. So what is the acceptable number of deaths by accidents on roads? Well, I mean, in Arkansas, where I live, every day someone dies on the highways, mostly in single-car accidents. Every day. The governor hasn't been impeached. Legislature hasn't been fired. We haven't done anything about it. I guess it's okay. So I'd say maybe for Arkansas, maybe 200, 300 people a year, it's okay. Yeah, Aunt Millie died in a car accident, but, you know, we had the funeral and we move on. What's the acceptable standard for, let's say, gun deaths? So is it 1, 100? It's like 37,000 deaths a year. Is that okay? I guess it's okay because, I mean, you know, gun shows are a big business. We like them. I got a bunch of guns in my house, too. And you probably don't here in San Francisco, but you know, I'm from Arkansas. You got to understand that. And so the standard is pretty loose. But if you ask, what's the standard for people to be, how many people can you afford to lose in a terrorist incident? That guy with the bomb in his underpants, I mean, that practically caused the impeachment of the President of the United States when they caught him. So the standard must be zero. So if you say the standard is zero, then you're going to have to give up some of your civil liberties. And I don't know how to get the balance right, but what we know right now is that it's going the other direction. Because with ISIS, with the threats to the United States, is there any one of you, if you were in a position of authority, who would say, don't wake me up in the middle of the night with a critical piece of information. Don't make the final effort to find that bomber if he's in the United States. Don't search emails and phone calls with people talking to Yemen or Syria because we might catch some ordinary Americans in the process and it might be embarrassing to them or they might not even know it. But in principle, let those conversations happen. And if he sets off a bomb in Times Square and it kills a couple of people, so what? We're losing, you know, 60,000 a year to other causes. It's a nation of 320 million. It's no big loss. None of you would say that. Every one of you, if you were in a position of authority, would say, do everything you can to keep this country safe. That's the responsibility of the President of the United States. So we've got a huge security industrial complex. And until we can work long term against the challenge of terrorism abroad and here, it's probably going to get larger. Just have to face it. It's something we should be alert to. We're going to have to work it. Eisenhower warned us about the military-industrial complex, and we've worked it. Got to pay attention to this one.
That is a terrific note on which to end our conversation. My thanks to this wonderful audience who bombarded you with fantastic questions, as they always do at the Commonwealth Club. My thanks and the Commonwealth Club's thanks to Wesley Clark for his service to our country, for sharing his thoughts so openly and enthusiastically with us, and for making a contribution to political tolerance and compromise in our country.
Corey, thanks a lot. Thanks for hosting. Thank you all. This is it.
raise your hand.
I want the last word here. Look, we have to come together as a nation. We've got to stop this dysfunctional politics in America. And if we come together, we can put this country on the right direction. I've laid out a blueprint for it. We should hold our political leaders responsible for coming together. That should be the standard.
And on that